This is the current federal tax developments here for the week of June the 27th, 2016. Current federal tax developments, as always, is brought to you by Nichols Patrick CP Incorporated and your state society of CPAs. This week, we're going to look at unforgivable errors. And we're going to talk about a couple of error issues that have popped up this week in the area of taxes, some issues with taxpayers that had a problem. We're going to talk about first a couple of things. We're going to note that the IRS again had to shut down the electronic filing PIN program. So we'll give you a quick discussion of our developments there. We'll talk about a taxpayer's mistake in dealing with an inherited annuity that it turned out couldn't be easily fixed and we ended up being a problem. We have an issue with charitable documentation. Another unforgivable error is not having your documentation, as a taxpayer discovered, where a taxpayer lost both cash and non-cash contributions. We have two proposed regulations dealing with deferred compensation, one dealing with 409 Cap A, the one applicable to most all non-qualified deferred compensation arrangements, where the IRS is going to make some changes in 19 specific areas, they tell us. And we also have proposed regulations dealing with 457 government and not-for-profit organization programs that are covered by 457, and we'll talk about those. We also have, finally, in the unforgivable error category, we have a taxpayer who, despite having advice from both an attorney and a CPA firm that this transaction was dangerous and potentially would open them up to transferee liability, went ahead with it. And unfortunately, it turns out the advice they got from their attorney and their CPA was, in the view of the court, good advice. The bad news was, of course, that it's advice they failed to follow. That creates issues for our taxpayers in this week's session. Now, we're coming up on, we're here in summer, and for those who are not aware, Form 8971, basis conformity, has now arrived. Isn't that wonderful for those of us who are dealing with that? And be aware, one thing, this is this particular week, we have the first funds that are due coming up this week, and maybe now you've decided I should know something about this, or even better, you suddenly realize that, hey, there's this problem, and you're ready to hit the little panic button. Well, we're going to hopefully give you some help here in the future, have some ways to try to help you hit the delete button on that. One of the ways we're going to do that, coming up in the month of July, we have a pair of courses coming up in two different locations that will deal with, among other things, the wonders of the new Form 8971. First, coming up on July 8th, I'll be doing a session for the Washington Society of CPAs. It will be webcast. It's going to be estate and gift taxation planning and compliance. It will be again on July 8th. It'll go from 8 a.m. to 3:30 p.m. Pacific time. It will deal with the new Form 8971. That'll be part of, obviously, our issue here. For those who are not aware, that's our basis conformity form, which is a major problem if you have to file it. Because guess what? It's big estates with big money. Because these days, unless you have to, you know, you really don't have a small estate that's going to be filing a 706, certainly not one that needs to file the basis conformity forms. You need to understand what that is. Or if you have a client who inherits from a large estate, that also creates a problem understanding how those forms work. This is an area where if you don't know what you're doing, the mistake could be very expensive because by definition, it is an issue where the other side, the litigation money makes sense normally because the numbers are big enough. I'll also be doing on July the 14th a session in Arizona that'll be live and webcast that'll talk about assisting the survivors, the CPA's role in the decedent's estate. That course will also cover the new Form 8971 and in addition talk to you about all of the issues that deal with the Uniform Principal and Income Act here in the state of Arizona for those of you who are taking it here in Arizona. Again, the Form 8971, brand new, important. If you have not kept up to speed on that and all of the key regulations that really explain how that thing worked came out during tax season, it's time to get up to speed. Whether or not you're filing one of those forms or you're going to have a client who's inherited from an estate that has had one of those forms, it's important to understand how those rules work. So let's move on. Now we're going to talk about some of the issues that have happened this week. And the first one I want to talk about, which I don't have a slide for those of you who are looking at the video, we're going to talk about the issue of the IRS did make a change in the work opportunity credit. Now you may remember Congress last year extended the work opportunity credit and expanded it. And the only problem, of course, is we all have to be pre-certified for the work opportunity credit. that creates a series of problems that we run into. So what we have there is obviously nobody got pre-certified last year. The IRS had earlier this year in Notice 2016-22 provided for an extended due date that said as long as you hired somebody through May 31st, you would be able to, if you applied for certification by the end of June, be able to treat that person as pre-certified. Well, it turns out the forms didn't come out very quickly, so the IRS in Notice 2016-40 that was issued on June the 17th has now kicked those dates back. The date you have to hire somebody by is now August 31st, and the date you can get that their certification for those hired through August 31st has now moved back to September the 28th. So you have some extra time. So if you're dealing with that, you're not having to rush around this week. No, that's only for the 8971 to get those done. Oh, yeah, don't also forget, it's June 30, so all the FBAR forms are due this week as well. Hey, lots of things happen the end of June. You thought June was a nice, boring time in tax practice. Turns out it's getting less boring because we have all kinds of neat things going on. Next up, you may have heard about this. The IRS was forced to halt the electronic filing PIN program for a second time this year. This was a website announcement that was posted on the 23rd. The electronic PIN system, you may remember, had been attacked in February. That is one of the various methods a taxpayer can use to file a return electronically, and it allows the taxpayer to use that method to verify who they are. It is used heavily by the consumer tax services, that, you know, the ones that are consumer self-preparation services, because it's one of the methods where the taxpayer who can't quite figure out how to read lines off last year's return or can't find last year's return can still be allowed to electronically file using a PIN. The problem was that hackers figured out how to get into this thing and how to basically create PINs and then file fake returns using those PINs, which was not a good thing. Well, the problem, of course, is, and the system has lots of flaws. We discussed those back when the first problems came up. The problem, of course, is, though, that the software industry, which has this all keyed into their programs, wanted this thing to stay in place for now. You know, they issued all the software, and if you're somebody like Intuit doing TurboTax, you don't really want to have to roll out brand new releases or updates to people to deal with this issue or rewrite this section. You know, you finish the 2015 return work. You don't charge a whole lot per client or per taxpayer. So you really don't want to go back and have to do a rewrite. So they want to keep that in, not have to explain and have support calls where it doesn't work. So the IRS went ahead and brought this system back up. Last week, what happened was they noticed that there was unusual activity, meaning an apparent restartup of automated attacks trying to gain access to the program. So they have shut it down again. My guess is this may be the final shutdown because the IRS states on their website that they had intended to, you know, consider shutting this down entirely. My guess is it's not coming back. My own take on it, good riddance, because it put in danger individuals who were not going to be filing returns in that manner because everybody, including you, me, everybody else in the country, was open to attack under that program. Good news is it may be down. This is probably only bad news if you're Intuit or one of the other major software providers that now is going to have support calls from people wondering why they can't get their PINs accepted. You know, they're on extension. They can't get it done. That could make things a little bit interesting here in the interim. We'll see how all of that runs out. In any event, interesting little aside. So we're back. More problems and more attacks on the e-filing system. Next up, we're going to talk about a private letter ruling, 2016-25001. This particular private letter ruling deals with a problem of a taxpayer who had received a distribution, basically a private who'd received inherited funds from an annuity on their father's death. They signed a distribution form believing that it was really a form authorizing a Section 1035 exchange of the annuity. Now, as you're probably aware, with non-qualified annuities, non-qualified means not held in a qualified retirement plan. A couple years ago, we were told by the IRS that it's okay to 1035 exchange an inherited annuity. But the problem is you have to do a 1035 exchange. Unlike the provisions that deal with IRAs, where if you own an IRA, you can go ahead, and if it's not an inherited IRA, you could take a distribution and within 60 days take that money elsewhere, redeposit an IRA and have that count. There's no equivalent provision for annuities. Also, there's no equivalent provision that we find in Section 408 that allows the IRS to waive a non-compliant rollover. So we have no special rules there. Well, that turns out to be a problem because in this case, the taxpayer takes it to his tax return preparer, and the preparer notices that, of course, he's got a 1099-R that shows a distribution from the plan, not something showing a 1035 exchange. Preparer notes it's a problem. Taxpayer files for an extension, asks the IRS for relief. The problem in this case is, as noted, the IRS declines to grant relief because, as I explained earlier, there is no provision of the law that really allows us to get relief if we foul this up. This is effectively, as I mentioned to start this, our theme for the week, an unforgivable error. If a client makes this error, there's no easy way to fix it. It was a done deal. It means you got to be very careful if you have an inherited annuity to make sure the client properly fills out the paperwork and gets things rolled over. It also means you tell clients who are inheriting such items that they probably need to talk with you and they and the insurance companies have to carefully work out. If we're going to roll this over, we want to double and triple check to make sure it actually got rolled over. Continuing on with taxpayer errors, let's go on to the next little problem here. This is the case of Hogg versus Commissioner, Tax Court Summary Opinion 2016-29, issued on June the 22nd. The taxpayer in this case, there were a number of issues, but this taxpayer claimed both cash and non-cash contribution. And they claimed, hey, we gave $20. We each went to different churches. We will assume from some of the facts in this that the marriage was kind of in trouble because one of the other issues that will happen is the wife will move out here at the end of the year. They claimed contributions of $20 per week to separate churches they attended. And the wife claimed that she gave away a lot of property when she moved. So when she moved out of the house, she claimed she gave away all this property. The taxpayers had put these claims on their tax return, and among other things, this ended up in front of the IRS. The IRS ends up questioning this on exam. Well, here's the problem. The taxpayers did not maintain the required documentation. Remember, for any contribution, you must have either a check, canceled check, other evidence of payment, credit card slip, whatever you might have, or you've got to have a receipt from the charity. That's even for a $1 contribution or dropping money in a Salvation Army bucket over Christmas, you still need to have the proof of the contribution. Claiming you put $20 into the offering plate at church every week, even if you did it, that's non-deductible unless you got somebody to give you a receipt for that. That's something that's very important to understand. Similarly, she made claims about what she had given to the charity for non-cash contributions. She claimed contributions with values in excess of $250, but she had no such receipts from the charity indicating that she had received nothing of value or detailing the amounts, or not necessarily the amounts, but detailing what had been given in sufficient detail. The IRS had only allowed the below $250 number because she didn't have qualifying receipts. The tax court agreed, reducing, so getting rid of all the cash contributions and reducing her non-cash contributions from a few thousand dollars to $250. The real problem here is if you do not maintain the required documentation, you're going to lose your deductions. The problem we've got here is explaining to clients that this is not just nobody would really enforce that. We've had way too many cases here the past couple of years that makes it very clear the IRS will enforce this. They are raising it on exam. They will enforce it. Your clients have to understand this is a zero-based item. It also means when you're preparing returns, if you become aware the client does not have the material, there really is no justification for leaving that on the return. You have to tell clients it's zero-based. We have no option. The rules are just like the rules on cars where if you don't have the documentation, you don't get the deduction. If you don't have documentation for mileage, you don't get it. If you don't have the documentation on charity, you don't get it. If you fail to communicate that to the client, it sets up potential liability for you because on exam, a client is going to immediately say that you never told them. make sure you document that you told your clients about these rules and make sure you actually enforce them. Because if you actually wink and say, oh, don't worry about it, the client's going to take that as meaning that you say it's okay not to get it. Again, when things go wrong, they'll look for you to pay the amounts that are due. Next up, we have a pair of proposed regulations. This is Regulation 123854-12 that was issued on June the 22nd. These regulations deal with IRC Section 409 Cap A, the infamous non-qualified deferred compensation rules. And the IRS in this area announced proposed revisions to the existing regulations under 409 Cap A. Remember, we added this section in 2004. They've issued revisions to 19 specific areas. Some of this is meant to shut down abuse. Some of the changes here are meant to be taxpayer friendly. Most of them are relatively taxpayer friendly. Some of the abuse areas are going to cause us a couple of issues. But for the most part, it's going to be mainly taxpayer friendly. One piece of good news, the IRS told us that even though these were issued only as proposed regulations and we do not have the equivalent temporary regulations issued at the same time, taxpayers may rely on these regs. So for the interim, what it really means is for most of these items, a taxpayer can use either the current regulations or the taxpayer can use the temporary regulations. Now, the IRS has announced in these pair of regulations that some of these things they claim are merely stating what's really no change in law, and they will fight you if you try to go on a different position. So just be aware of that on a couple of them. Now, we're not going to go through all 19 things that were changed because many of them are not going to be relevant to you. But if you have non-qualified deferred comp plans, you definitely want to go through. In our write-up for this week, we have listed for you all 19 things that they're going to make changes in, as well as link directly to the proposed regs. So if you're dealing with this, you're not going to get coverage of this in about 3 minutes. You want to go ahead and go see the details. A couple of the key things, though, that are brought up in here that you should be aware of. They did offer some relief for death-related payments. The problem is the timing rules there for payments related to certain actions was basically fairly narrow. And a lot of people pointed out that when somebody dies, it takes some time to close up the estate, verify the death in some cases, and assure that the payment goes to the right person. So these proposed regulations will say if the trigger point in your non-qualified deferred comp arrangement is because the taxpayer or a beneficiary has died, you basically can make the payment all the way through the end of the year following the end of the year in which the individual in question died. So if somebody were to die today, it means you have until December 31st of 2017 to make the payment, and it still can be considered a death-related payment under your non-qualified deferred compensation arrangement. So that's basically a taxpayer-friendly change because it makes it where administratively it was very difficult before to make that work. Other big change comes if you're in education, especially those of you in the university setting. There was a change in the educator rule that removed the maximum deferral rule. The issue for the educator rule, we're going to go from maximum deferral of $18,000, the maximum could be deferred, over to a provision that will not limit the deferral, but will instead say that you can only have this special rule for deferral on somebody whose maximum earnings is less than $265,000. Both of these are tied to provisions in the qualified retirement plan rules that are inflation adjusted. For those who don't remember what the problem was, in many cases in education, remember summer vacation, right? Remember that? Where you had like 3 months during the summer you didn't go to school. Well, of course, teachers would work 9 months, and then they'd have 3 months they weren't working. The problem, of course, is that some people aren't so good at managing cash flow, and going 3 months without a paycheck is difficult. So what many school districts allow a teacher to do is choose between being paid for the 9 months they really work, so basically having all their paychecks for the year over 9 months, or having a portion of each paycheck held back by the district and paid out to them over the summer. So basically, when they're not working, they'll get 3 months. Under the regulations or a special rule that we had that came out after the regulations, we got a special option that allowed for such programs to count, but limited the maximum deferral. The maximum amount that could be kicked from 1 year into another year and spread over the summer to $18,000. Some people had complained that, especially in a university setting or these days with special school settings where somebody may have a different 3 months off, that it's very possible for somebody to have a maximum deferral depending upon what part of the year they, what part of the year the deferral goes over when it gets paid out, that could exceed $18,000 with salaries starting at right around $80,000. There are ways to structure this depending upon when you start, what part of the year it is, how much your pay is, et cetera, saying, look, this is a problem. So what the service has said is, okay, we're going to change that. We're going to move it into the reg instead of having it in a special revenue procedure. And we're going to change the number so that the $265,000 maximum earnings will be the key instead of worrying about how much you defer. As we noted originally, taxpayers may now, as the rules state, taxpayers are allowed to rely on these rules right now in the interim. There are a few cases where a taxpayer will need to, where they say we're not really changing the law, so you want to take a look at that. But taxpayers are able to rely on these good news. So for most of these, you could choose either to use these rules or you could choose to use the rules that were in place under the old system. So you've got two choices here, which is, you know, kind of useful, shall we say, for the taxpayer. As I said, there were a pair of proposed regs. So the second proposed reg that we have deals with governmental plans. This is under Section 457, Regulation 1471906.07. This deals with both eligible and ineligible 457 plans. The key issue you're going to look at here, we're not going to spend a whole lot of time here because not a whole lot of you probably deal with this directly, is dealing with substantial risk of forfeiture, which for what are called ineligible plans or 457F plans. A couple of key things it does. It allows non-compete agreements now to be considered to impose a substantial risk of forfeiture in some situations. You want to read the details if you have that sort of plan. And it also looks at cases where you can defer taxation electively on income otherwise be eligible to receive in cash. The IRS had previously indicated they didn't believe that could be covered by a 457 plan. Now they're saying, well, if you meet certain requirements, we're okay. So if you deal with such plans, realistically, you need to go and you're setting them up for a government agency or for a not-for-profit organization. You really need to go read the rules here, find out what we were told. So you want to go read these regs, these regulations. The details for them are in our materials that you can take a look at on the website, as well as the materials we're going to make available to you to download. Okay, next up, final case for the day. We have a little problem here. This is a case where another one of these unforgivable errors. This is the case of the estate of Richard Marshall versus Commissioner. This was issued on June the 20th. Now, the funny part about this case was it doesn't really deal with an estate tax issue, though you often see some of them, you see estate. Rather, what it deals with here is a corporation. The corporation had been a contractor. It had contracts. And it had some disputes outstanding on those contracts. Now, in the interim, the individual who had been running the company, Dad, you know, let's call him, dies. And the kids don't really run the company. The company's not functioning by the time we get to this point. But the C corporation had been kept open, and it appears to be a C. Presumably, we'll accept that it is. It, you know, was kept open. And eventually, they settled these claims for some really big payouts. Now the problem is this corporation is going to owe a bunch of tax, and of course they're going to want to liquidate the thing because it has nothing left going on. Well, they got approached by an organization, and this is one, a Midco transaction for those who are aware of where we're going here. And they got approached in that situation by somebody who gave them a too-good-to-be-true offer where their stock would be purchased by this third party, avoiding the double taxation. And this third party supposedly had some magic way through losses it was going to be able to move into the corporation to offset entirely the gain inside that corporation so they would be able to avoid the tax. Well, the taxpayer thought, oh, this sounds great because I'm going to get a lot better deal selling stock than not selling stock. Unfortunately, the taxpayer, now maybe not unfortunate, this actually was a good move. The bad news was not paying attention to it. The taxpayer consulted both with an attorney and with an international accounting firm. The advisors in both cases told them that they thought this was a highly risky structure that could impose transferee liability because they, you know, they said, look, this is like a transaction. The IRS has identified as a listed transaction. They also tell them that because of that, you know, you need to report it. It also, and the IRS is going to assert that you got this money. You effectively took money from the corporation because you transferred it with the full understanding that the company, that the money inside the company was going to be used to pay you out and that there'd be insufficient assets inside the company to pay the taxes. The taxpayer said, well, you know, I talked to the promoters pushing this and they tell me it's all fine. So I think I'm going to go ahead and do this because I'm going to save a bunch of taxes. Well, unfortunately for the taxpayer, it turns out that the attorney and the CPA firm were correct. The taxpayer, despite being warned that they could owe a bunch of taxes if they went through with this, went through with it. And not only did they owe the tax, they also got nailed for the penalties that have been imposed on the corporation. Now, they argued, wait, we can't be liable for those because those didn't exist. And we supposedly bankrupted the corporation. In this case, the tax court said, sorry, guys. You knew when you did this, you know, that was a foreseeable consequence of what was going on. You cannot claim now that suddenly, hey, we're not liable for that. The key takeaway from this, first thing is always be sure to point out to your clients the problems. The good news in this case for the advisors is, at least for the CPA firm and the law firm, is they're basically covered in this because they told the client this was going to turn out really, really badly. And guess what? It did. The real bad news is if an advisor had gone along with this, now that's when the liability problems come back. The real issue, too, is to advise your clients that, you know, you cannot rely on a promoter. It's not going to get you out of penalties. You should pay attention to if you're going to do something that sounds too good to be true. That's a reason why you want to get the third-party advisor into the mix. You don't want to let this kind of sit where it is. Well, you know, as I said, we're coming up on summer. And hey, in Phoenix now this week, it was 118 last Sunday. Today, it's only supposed to be 108. I'm recording this on Saturday, so nice. But it is some time to go out and get some stuff done. And I want to remind you, you want to book your CPE now with your state CPE societies. There's been a lot happened over the past year or two that makes it very dangerous to be taking what we might call inexpensive or, you know, free lunch CPE. Especially that type of CPE that comes out of some book that was last written 5 years ago, but it was really cheap because you could sign, you know, answer like five questions and pick up your CPE. Your clients are paying you for your expertise. And in the past couple of years, we've had major changes in tax and accounting and auditing, all of which you need to get up to speed. For instance, we've had just, you know, in the past few years, portability. That's a state tax for the rest of us. You know, we need to understand those rules and have details with that. It's really useful to have a full day session to talk with somebody so you can ask questions. In A&A, we have two big things that have come down recently or are coming at us. We've had the change, the revenue recognition project. This is approaching rapidly. How is that going to impact your clients who need GAAP financials? How about the lease changes? You know, your clients have GAAP financials. They have loan covenants. Are the lease changes going to cause us problems when they come in a few years down the line, going to cause your clients to go out of line with loan covenants? If you're signing loans right now for 4 or 5 years out, you may need to be very careful about those covenants because GAAP's going to change in the interim. And when we have to put all of those leases on the balance sheet, ratios are going to have problems. We also have the upcoming major partnership audit changes. Those are all something you need to have sessions on and discuss how that's going to work, especially as that continues to develop over the next couple of years. And finally, state taxation, something we often skip. And this is state sales tax, which is big even if you are in a state like Washington that doesn't impose an income tax. You still got this problem. The states are attacking Quill. And the big issue there is they're trying to get after out-of-state sellers. Colorado had a huge win we talked about here earlier in the year. Louisiana has now adopted a law that is virtually identical to Colorado's that will require reporting, turn in your customers, even though you don't operate in the state. And if the 10th Circuit's right, it would apply in Louisiana too. You need to get up to date because your clients expect you to understand these things. Again, it's important to understand that your state societies have courses that deal with these issues. Check your state society catalogs and look at getting up to speed. Your clients are paying you to be experts. don't end up being don't have lack of expertise because you just decided that you would go ahead and find free CPE at a free lunch. Make sure you're getting value CPE, not necessarily inexpensive CPE. Sometimes the inexpensive stuff is worth exactly what you have paid for it. This has been the current federal tax developments for the week of June the 27th. Be sure to catch our daily updates at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. You can download a PDF with articles on all of today's topics on the weekly update page. Also, be sure to send any questions or comments to Ed Zollers at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com or follow me on Twitter at Ed Zollers. We'll post there as developments come up. And be sure to join us next week as we continue with more developments in the area of federal taxes.